from the ages.
Primitive drums and smoke and echoes from mountainsides were some of the first means used by man to project his ability to communicate out of the normal range of his voice. Drums were probably first, because man initially feared fire.
This was taken from an archaeologist's notes written long ago.
This is Face to the Future, a new transcribed series on this station produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command. Its conductor is Del Vina, well-known broadcaster, author, lecturer, a lady of adventure as well. It's Face to the Future, and here is our hostess, Del Vina.
Welcome again to Face to the Future. When a man named Lazar Ludovic Zamenhof was born just a little more than 100 years ago in Bialystok, a frontier town near Poland, Lithuania, and Byelorussia, his earliest memories were a babble of languages. Local officials spoke in Russian, the nobility in Polish, the peasants in Lithuanian and Byelorussian, and the shopkeepers in Yiddish. From this welter of inability to communicate completely between peoples in one small city, he became interested in developing a common language. Being adept at many languages himself, he eventually wrote a book about a common tongue, which he signed with the pen name of Dr. Esperanto, and that common language became known as Esperanto. It started with 904 roots, from which 10,000 words could be formed. The fascination of men for communications, from earliest time, has taken many forms. The International Morse Code is used throughout the world.
Hello?
The telephone was first to transmit voice great distances. And from the payloads fired aloft with great missiles, the strange voices of telemetry came back to us from as far away as the moon. Communications have come to mean the important contribution to our deterrence posture in their ability to take surprise out of an enemy air attack. Without surprise, even the dullest enemy planner can easily visualize the losses he would suffer fighting his way into the North American target system, were it fully alerted against him. As communications have improved our defenses against manned air attack, refinements in these communications are being brought about daily, striving for an answer to the much faster-moving intercontinental ballistic missile threat, which is now pointed at us from sites in Russia and Siberia.
From where I sit here in the Combat Operations Center of the North American Air Defense Command in Colorado Springs, Colorado, it is easy to see we need some fast, hard work to provide us with a means of fighting off an intercontinental ballistic missile attack. This means we not only have to have the weapon, which can move fast enough to do it, but we need the improved radar to see the missile and the guidance system to ensure its destruction.
That was Colonel R.L. Gould, Director of the Combat Operations Center at the North American Air Defense Command. This is one of the protective military forces at work in the Western world today to ensure that men cannot only communicate with each other in better, more far-reaching ways, but also to ensure that men are around to explore new means of communication with each other. To find out just how widely mankind is currently able to make contact with his fellows, I'm going to ask you to listen in on a recent speech by Dr. J.R. Pierce of the Bell Laboratories in New Jersey.
Well, in all civilized countries, there are adequate communications within land masses. People in Europe can communicate with one another. They have television across their the borders of their country. They can communicate with Great Britain. But the ocean forms a barrier. It has been partially spanned by submarine cables to give high-quality broadcast circuits as well as telephone circuits.
How many people would you think are out of reach of this means of contact? Here is Dr. Pierce continuing.
There are still many billions of people, I suppose, with whom we do not even have the quality of telephone circuits that we have within the continental United States. And as yet, we have no broadband television circuits. We cannot instantaneously see some important event abroad, and it's here that satellites may help us. But it is quite possible that with adequate research, satellite communication will come into being as a practical thing, will span the oceans, and will enable us both to hear and see people in all parts of the world.
For those who fear that many of the answers we seek in current explorations and experiments are only useful for military purposes, it's fairly obvious that peaceful use of most of the discoveries is possible to an even greater degree. While a communication satellite in the sky has military surveillance capabilities, it can also open the whole of the Earth's surface to broadcasting and telecasting beams, to telephone and telegraphy in a degree not now possible. Here's my next guest. Will you identify yourself, please?
Well, I'm K.J. Bossert, assistant to the Vice President Engineering of Convair, located in San Diego.
Your company, along with many others, is working on the communication satellite program. Since this will be a tremendously expensive feat, how many will be required?
The higher you go, the fewer satellites you need, but also the better optical equipment you need in order to observe a certain feature on the Earth. Now, regarding the 24-hour orbit, the satellite takes 24 hours to go around, which is the same time it takes for the Earth to go around.
Where, in relation to the Earth, does this satellite have to be established?
Over the equator. In its so-called 24-hour orbit, it will always be over the same spot, which is a rather interesting trick.
Well, how high is that 24-hour orbit?
That one is 22,000 miles high. For radio, this is quite feasible. For all practical purposes, such a satellite would be stationary in space. It would be stationary anyway to an observer who is on the surface of the Earth. And therefore, it can be used as a communication relay, a radio communication relay. It could be used to relay television programs, for instance. It will always be there. You can use a narrow beam in your broadcast because you know exactly where to point it, and your target will stay there. From the standpoint of communication, either commercial or military, this is very important.
Could you expand on that a bit?
The existing channels of communication today are getting overburdened. We're sending more messages than we can conveniently absorb with the means we have. So here, then, we have the possibility of adding new channels of communication. We have the additional benefit that these kind of communications are very difficult to be jammed. It is difficult, virtually impossible, for an enemy to interfere with such a beam.
What is the minimum number of satellites which would be needed 22,000 miles up?
You need a minimum of 3 satellites, you see, so that satellites 2 and 3 can always see satellite number 1 and relay whatever they receive from the ground.
How fast does this trio of satellites have to go just to stay in place?
It goes some 10,000 feet per second.
Would such a communications link as this, exposing the whole Earth's surface, have an effect on man's ultimate communications dream, a world language?
If you mean by universal language, is it a language by which everybody would use when they want to intercommunicate? The answer is definitely yes. As a matter of fact, I think English today is, to a very large extent, already this universal language.
The forerunner of these communications developments has already become an accomplished public fact, and it was in English. Do you recall the time in 1958 when the world was electrified by this voice broadcasting from an orbit in space?
This is the President of the United States speaking. Through the marvels of scientific advance, my voice is coming to you from a satellite circling in outer space.
At this point, I'm going to ask Carol Bosser to point out some of the implications of communications and its language on the year 2000.
There is a nationalistic pride involved, you know, in changing your language. As a matter of fact, I think English today is, to a very large extent, already this universal language. Although, of course, we probably will get some competition from the Russian, maybe even from the Chinese. And I would say that it would behoove us, if we're going to go into this worldwide coverage by radio and TV and so forth, to get there first. Otherwise, it might well happen that the other language, Russian, might become the universal language, which would be most unfortunate for us Americans, because we certainly are not adept at taking on new languages.
So no matter how far mankind has come from smoke signals and drums, the distances he can still go to improve his lot, his safety, and his riches make us appear to be only on the threshold. By communications, he can be better informed, universally knowledgeable, less likely to be surprised, detect more opportunities for human enterprise.
This has been Face to the Future, a transcribed series on this station produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command and featuring Delvina with her parade of interesting guests. Be with us next time as we put our face to the future.